The next session is Buddhist attitude in family life, marriage, sex, and relationships. Ajahn Brahm.
Thank you. I'll get on into the subject very quickly.
Thank you.
But I only have a short time in this session. And of course, most Buddhists do not become monks. Most Buddhists will get married, and they will have sex, they will have children, they will have a family, an extended family. And you know that much of your happiness and also suffering lie around your family, especially your relation with your husband, with your wife, or even if you're gay, with your partner. And that's such an important part of life that I think it's a shame that Buddhist monks don't give more talks about relationships, marriage, and even sex as well. And again, even though that my experience of those things is 30, 40 years old now, when I had my last relationship with a woman, still that living as a monk and understanding the ways of the mind and doing lots of counseling, you've got a lot of understanding and knowledge of what goes on, especially the basics of having a good relationship with somebody else. And of course, that once you have a relationship with somebody else, that relationship binds you, and it actually makes you a different person than you were before. It's before you have a relationship, it's just me. After a relationship, it's us. There's another sort of mechanism happens there. In Thailand, whenever there was a marriage, we'd always describe it like changing from a human being to an elephant. Because a human being has 2 feet, an elephant has 4 feet. So once you have a relationship with someone else, you're not a two-footed person, you're a four-footed person. And of course, with an elephant, the front 2 feet and the back 2 feet have to go in the same direction. If you imagine an elephant, if the front feet go in one direction, the back feet goes in another direction, the elephant falls over. And once an elephant falls over, it's very difficult to get up again. And so with a marriage, with a partnership, with a relationship, it has to be some degree, and quite a huge degree, of selflessness on both sides. So when you start out in a relationship, please understand it's not me anymore, it's us. Which means also that if you have a problem there, it's not your husband's fault, it's not your wife's fault, it's not his problem, it's not my problem, it's our problem. So we actually change some of the language there. Instead of me, or he, or she, it's us. Now when you understand that, the relationship is important, it's the space between you which is important. Not me, not him, not her, but us. And once we understand that, the mechanics of a successful relationship is focusing on that area which is between you. Not which is in you, or in him, or her, but between us. And when we focus on that relationship, that's the place where we can actually make a successful relationship if we don't take heed to how we're reacting to each other, what's in between us, then the relationship can very easily fall apart. The problem is, most times when people fall in love, it seems so easy. Everything is perfect. That woman is just so beautiful. That man is just so sensitive and wonderful. And of course, because we are heedless, that's why the relationship doesn't last. There was an old simile of lighting a fire using paper. You get a big flame and a lot of heat very quickly. But the paper fire never lasts very long because it's not substantial. So when you start a relationship with someone else, it is like a paper fire, it's falling in love. It's a big flame, but it's not solid. So of course, to make a fire, once you have the paper alight, you've got to put small pieces of wood, what we call kindling. And that will take the fire. When the small pieces of wood take the fire, you can put on bigger pieces of wood and then bigger pieces of wood. And once there's enough heat there, then you can put on the logs. And once those logs take the flame and start burning, then you know that that's a substantial fire which won't go out very easily. In the same way, you know, you start a relationship just with man and wife, boy and girl meeting each other, it becomes like a paper fire first of all. You get married and then you start experiencing things together. The experiencing things together and sharing things is putting the kindling on. And as that kindling takes the fire. Then you have what we call in a relationship the big logs, which are the problems in your relationship. It's those problems are like the big logs. If you can work out those problems together, it's really us working at this, not me, not her, but us. Then it's those big logs, once they take the flame, once you work out the difficult times together, the problems together, and you get through them, that's when you have a solid relationship. So understanding that the problems which you face in your relationship together are actually, if they're used properly, that's the glue, that's the fuel which will give you a very solid relationship together. So when the problems come, first of all, accept them, you know they're going to happen, and work at them together. And if you do work at them together and you get through them together, then you know we have that bond of a relationship. We've been through stuff together. Because you know this is how relationships happen. When we do things together, when we work together, especially we have a problem, a difficulty, we solve it together, that's where we get that sense of relationship community. It might be just like the BGF. When they organize somebody together, it's difficult, but they go there and they do it and they succeed. There's that sense of friendship. We're a team. We did it. And that's what happens in a relationship together. It has to take working together. But when it's working together, there always has to be a selflessness there. Which is why I still say that marriage is a valid spiritual path. You have to give up your own concerns and ideas, what you want in a marriage. That's why it is maybe not as an intense a path as being a monk or a nun, but it's still, you have to have a lot of renunciation when you get married and have a relationship. There's also a degree of celibacy as well, because when you get married, you're committing yourself to one girl, to one boy. I don't mean like, you know, you have one girl and one boy. Yeah, just have one girl or one boy. Not both. That's what I meant. You just committed yourself to one partner in life. And it's nature. You may be married, you may be committed, but you might see someone who looks more beautiful, more attractive, because this is the nature of your human body. Now your hormones will react to somebody else. And because of that, you will be tempted from time to time. That's nature. But just like as a young monk, I would be tempted several times. But I said, no, I want to be a monk. I'm not going to indulge those thoughts. I'm not going to break my precepts. So you stop. And that way that you become a good monk who can actually help and inspire others. In marriage, you may think that you're committed to that girl forever, but the time will come when you see someone else who's really attractive and really nice. And you've got to do the same sorts of things which I have to do, to say no. For you men, I'll share one of the tricks which I used to do when I was a young monk. If I saw a very beautiful girl, she'd be very, very attractive, I noticed the way that lust actually comes up. Because as soon as you see a nice girl, you actually look for that part of her which was the most beautiful. It could be her hair, her shape, her bosom or her bottom, whatever you like. That's what you go to straight away. And I realized that's actually the way of lust. You'd actually look at the thing which stimulated your lust even more. So because I was committed to being a monk and I did not want to leave my monkhood, to counter that, I made this little trick of mine. That whenever I saw a beautiful girl who I really liked, I deliberately not look for the parts of her which were even more beautiful, I start to look for her ugly parts. In particular, I'd look for the pimples on her face. And there was never one girl who didn't have a pimple. So once I saw her pimple, I realized she was not perfect. She was not like some Aphrodite, some Greek goddess of perfection. I realized that that girl was a human being. And so the fantasy started to disappear. So all of you men who are married, who are in relationships, if you actually do see a pretty girl, look for her pimples. If you are a man, or so if a woman, and you're married, you know, you've got a partner in life, and you see this other boy who looks really hot, don't just go for, you know, what you think is hot about him. Look for his faults. No, look for his dentures. He hasn't got dentures. Look for his fillings in his teeth. Or look for the grey bits of hair, or whatever it is, which will actually take away that desire for lust. But if you don't do that, and you indulge for too long, what happens is you get caught up in a fantasy, and you go crazy. It is a craziness when you have lust, and sometimes that it's so sad because you get a couple who are committed to each other, a man who loves his wife, a wife who loves her husband. They really are committed to them, but because of craziness, lust comes up into their mind and they literally go mad. They don't know what they're doing. And before they know it, they think they're just playing, they think they're in control. Before they know it, they're having an affair. And they think that it's no big problem, because lust is like that. It deceives us. And it is a problem. And it breaks your whole marriage. And that creates huge amounts of suffering. For you, who's the adulterer, but also for your partner and for your children as well. And it all comes because we were heedless at the very beginning. We thought we were in control. We didn't see that madness, that disease come up within us. So when you have a relationship, please commit yourself to that relationship, but also know the dangers. If, as long as you know the dangers are out there for you, you'll be able to take heed, and because you take heed, you don't get caught by those dangers. The Buddha gave the simile of just like this tree in the forest, and had these beautiful little creepers would go around you. And if you see the young creepers in the forest, they're just so soft and so tender, it's just so nice to be curled up around a tree. But after a while, that creeper, even though it's very soft at the beginning, it becomes very tough and very wooden, and it strangles the tree and kills it. So you've got to be very careful there, because what looks like being a lot of fun in the beginning can sometimes kill you. So if you are going to have a relationship, remember from the very beginning there's a lot of selflessness and renunciation are going to be asked of you. Not only do you, when you see someone else who attracts you, you have to say no, and that can be hard sometimes because you committed yourself to one person. That's a renunciation, that's a type of celibacy. But also with your partner, you have to actually learn how to let go of what you want as well. Instead of thinking what I want, what I need, it's what we need. So it's not self-fulfillment anymore, because self-fulfillment is just selfishness, and it does not lead to inner happiness. It's always renunciation of selfishness, of ego, of wanting, of desire and craving, which as the Buddha made very clear, that's the way to happiness. So as a partner in a relationship, if you can really let go and abandon your desires for us, for the family, then it does become a valid spiritual path. In other words, it's a path which leads to happiness. Sure, you'll have arguments, and sometimes even great arguments when you are in a relationship. Remember, when you are apart, it's like there's a distance between you. The closer you are, the more friction, the more heat there is. Which is why I've known many relationships, especially in Australia, where the husband has been working in the mining communities in the north of Western Australia, and so has been like 2 weeks off work, then 1 week back at home, then another 2 weeks away. And their relationships were wonderful when the wife had 2 weeks away from her husband. What happened next is the husband said, "Oh, I miss you, darling." And so they changed their job and get a job in Perth so they can stay at home all the time. And that's when the problems start. Because sometimes when there's a little bit of separation, there's not so much heat generated. But when they're with each other every day, obviously the different characters will create a little bit of friction. Now the point is, you know that's going to happen. When you know it's going to happen, then you can make sure you know how to deal with it when it happens. And of course, the way how to deal with these things when it happens is actually to keep things in perspective. The little argument, the reason why you have difference of opinion with your partner, even the anger or the words, always remember that there's something which is more important than that, which is your marriage, your love together. And I won't repeat the story of the chicken and the duck, that's in the book. Always remember that story about what is really important in marriage. Arguments are not as important as your commitment and love together. Once you understand that, you may lose your way for a short while, but always when you've had an argument, always make up. In Buddhism, the higher person, the most praiseworthy person, is not the one who's right, because in an argument, no one is right. You're both wrong. It doesn't matter, you know, who you think's in the right. If an argument, you're both wrong. The smart person, the wise person, the most praiseworthy person is the one who makes forgiveness first. The one who actually goes up and asks and says sorry. Doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. The one who's right is the one who says sorry first. And again, I saw that with my own parents. They would have arguments sometimes, because that was life. They were living in the same apartment together. It would happen. The most wonderful thing, which I remember from my childhood, they would have arguments, but my mother and father would make up. They'd say sorry to each other, they would hug and kiss in front of the children. So what I learned from that, I say, yeah, arguments happen in life, but I also saw solutions happen as well. When my parents made up, they kissed and said, I'm sorry. And that was very important to learn how to deal with relationships. Not only in marriage, with your parents, with your friends. Understand that arguments happen, but also understand the way out of arguments. It's not to decide who was right and who was wrong. There, I told you so. You were wrong again. Don't go onto that path. The best path is saying, look, we were both wrong. I argued with you. I shouted. Please, I ask forgiveness. I'm sorry. If you can do that, then you know the relationship is much stronger, because it's what is most important is what you remember. And it's the same with your sexuality in a marriage, because that's also part of a marriage. Now, you don't just get married to someone just to have a cook for you and just to have him, you know, bring you money. It's also the sexual relationship is there as well, because it's nature, you know, boys and girls. It's in the hormones, it's in the genes. But just like sexuality, it's a very powerful emotion, just like love is a powerful emotion. It can give you a lot of pleasure, but it can also give you enormous amounts of pain as well. And so in a marriage, in a relationship, what the best way to actually to express sexuality, again, it's not being selfish, what I want, the pleasure which I want to get from you. In a marriage, because it should be coming from love, it's an act of giving. So, as the husband, it should be how I can give my wife some pleasure. And a wife, how I can give my husband pleasure. It's an act of giving, not what I want, but what I can give to somebody else. Because I've always noticed what real love is. We express our love. Sometimes we can actually say, I love you, but that's not really how we express love to our loved ones. When we love someone, we want to give things to them. And it's Chinese New Year, you give gifts to people you love. It's soon to be Valentine's Day. On Valentine's Day, you give gifts to the people you love. If it's birthdays or Christmas in the West, you give gifts as an expression of your love to somebody else. And sexuality can be a gift which you can give to the person you love. Because you know that it will make them happy, it will give them pleasure, it will give them enjoyment. In the same way that you might take someone out for a really good meal, and you want to get the best meal for them. And that's an expression of love. Come out, what do you really like to eat? It doesn't what I want to eat, what you want to eat. Come, we go to your favourite restaurant tonight, because it's your special day. And it's the same with sexuality. You want to give to your partner. So when it's an act of giving, rather than a sense of receiving, it's an act of caring as well. It's a sexuality which is an expression of love, of caring, rather than a sexuality which is what I want, what I demand, my conjugal rights. And then it becomes a completely different flavour. There's too much of sexuality, which is what I need, what I want, my sexual needs. And then it becomes a selfish, it's not us anymore, it's not what I care about you, it's caring about me, 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 me again. And I've always found, whatever you do in life, whether you're a monk, a layman, laywoman, or whatever you are, if it's all about me, if it's about selfishness and ego, my needs, my requirements, that always leads to conflict and suffering. So, if it's any sexuality, please don't think about me, think about us, or about your partner. Be selfless. And if you can have that degree of selfless sex, that's a new word I've just coined, selfless sex. I don't know if you've heard that word before. If you can have that selfless sex, it really is an act of giving. It is an act of caring. It's an expression of love, rather than an expression of selfish pleasures and desires and wants. And you'll find it has a different quality and be more beautiful. And it also means you have to be more sensitive to the person you live with. Because you're not, again, thinking of you. You're thinking of what they need. And you're being more sensitive to their responses and what they're doing as you perform that sexual act. Now you're becoming more in tune with the person you live with. And you can see after that sexual act is completed, because throughout the whole time this has been your gift to your partner. You've been sensitive, you've been trying to care for them, look after them, turn them on, make them happy, give them pleasure, give them joy. Because that's been your motivation throughout that whole process. You can imagine that that has been an expression of your love towards your partner. It's been a highly intimate, sensitive act of giving. And as such, that would probably enhance your relationship even more, as your partner realized that you've given them all that pleasure, all that joy, as a gift. And of course, if you both do that, she's giving to you, and you're giving to her, the two of you together that way, you can probably actually get an even higher pleasure out of sexuality. Because you're being more sensitive to each other. So I think that will enhance even the pleasure of sexuality as well as your giving to each other, as your intimacy, your love towards one another. And of course that's the most important. I know I've heard and read before that in the sexual act, the woman wants intimacy and the man wants pleasure. But I think that's too much of a generalization. And I think that, okay, the man likes the pleasure, but they also like the intimacy as well. Yeah, sure, the woman likes the intimacy, but she also likes the pleasure as well. Now, one of the things I've found in my years as a monk, the difference between men and women are not that great. I know that book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, but people have been to Mars and never seen any men up there. They've been to Venus, there's no women up there. Men are from Earth, women are from Earth. In other words, we have a lot more in common than you'd ever give ground for. But sometimes we only see half the story because I'm in a man's body or you're in a woman's body or whatever body you're in. But actually, if you could see the other side, you'd find actually we do have a lot in common. Men do love intimacy. Women do love the pleasure. In fact, the sexual act is very much a joint venture. And so, and so that when it really is a joint venture, there is cooperation there, it will actually will enhance your relationship together. And of course, because it's a sensitivity, it's not what I want, it's what I can give to you. Again, there's never any of these problems of like using sex as a bargaining chip in your marriage, which sometimes happens, especially in Western marriages. You know, that, you know, if you behave yourself and come home early, I'll have sex with you. If you speak nicely to me, then okay, we'll have sex with you. And if it becomes like a bargaining chip in your marriage, there's something terribly wrong there. Because it's not, you know, something which I want, it's something which I need to give you. I care for you. I love you. That means I care. How can I make you happy? Even as a monk, we used to have this routine of when we used to give out the food in the morning. Because there was many monks, two or three monks would be given the job of taking the pots of food and actually serving the monks. And we just put, you know, a bit of food into each monk's bowl. And when I started doing that, I thought, you know, monks aren't supposed to have desires, so I'm going to just put the food anywhere. And one of the senior monks told me, no, no, don't do that. Because if you, you know, I'm a young monk, you're not supposed to be torturing your monks. You would like your food in different places in your bowl. You know, your sort of sweets over here, the curries over there, the savouries in another point in your bowl. So if that's what you would like, that's how you should treat your fellow monks. So find out what your fellow monks like. And then just give them that type of food, and give them a lot of that food. Be kind to your fellow monks, I was taught. And of course, that led to harmony. Even now in my monastery, I know roughly what my monks like. And I see if I can get them what they like. And that way, because I am really caring for them, and they know I care for them, even in their food habits, that's why we have a very harmonious, caring community in my monastery in Perth. So it's the same with you in your marriage together. Find out what your partner likes. That's your job. If you're a wife, find out the sorts of fashions which he likes, the perfume he likes, the makeup, the hairstyle which he likes. Be sensitive to him. And it doesn't take that much to work out what he likes. Just, you know, look at the other girls he looks at. As far as her, find out what she likes. That's your job as a husband, to be sensitive and find out what turns her on, what she likes, because your marriage is a gift. It's a gift to her. So you want to find out what makes her happy. And if that is what you're doing in your marriage, you'll find that there's love there, there's care. Those of you who have children, you love your child. When it's their birthday, what do you give them? Do you give them what they need, or do you give them what they want? What they think they'd really like? I remember my parents, that sometimes they thought they had a responsibility of making sure I ate the right foods and did the right things. But I had a grandmother, and my grandmother, she wouldn't worry about training me. Whenever I went to her house, she'd give me what I wanted. So sometimes I'd go in the middle of the morning, she'd just want some chips, because being an Englishman I like chips. She'd make me chips at any time of the day. I love my grandmother. My mother would never do that. She said, oh, you'll spoil your dinner, you won't eat what I cook. My grandmother, don't worry about that. If you want chips, you're my grandson, I love you, you can have them. How do you like them? She just wanted to turn me on, make me happy. And I thought, I learned a lot from that. If you've got a husband, it's not what he needs, it's what he wants. You give him that. If you've got a wife, it's not what she really needs to have, it's what she wants. Make her happy. And it doesn't take that much to get a good relationship together. Because if you really care about your partner, and you show that care by trying to make her happy, trying to make him happy, she'll realize that, she'll feel that, and she realizes there's someone in this world who really cares and thinks about me. Someone who really wants me to be happy. And that's such a rare thing in this world, that your relationship will be like this big fire, solid. Because you know what it's like in the world when you leave your home, you go to work, you go to the office, wherever you go, it's a struggle. So often you have to try and live up to somebody's expectations, you have to strive to make it in the world, people are always criticizing you, you've always got some boss above you who's telling you what to do, telling you your sales aren't good enough, you've got to work harder, do better, get more sales or whatever it is. And you have so much stress in your life where you're trying to perform to please others. In a marriage, at least you know you've got a partner at home who's not going to give you stress, who's not going to demand you do this or do that. You've got a partner who just wants to give to you, who doesn't demand at all. Wouldn't that be wonderful to have a partner like that? Someone you don't have to please. In other words, you know, you don't think, no, I've got to live up to this, I've got to live up to that, because you know your partner will accept you for who you are. So your job is actually to have that relationship of trust and sensitivity, of giving, whether it's in sexuality, in food, or whatever else you do in life. Don't have arguments about, you know, who's making the decisions. Make sure it is a joint decision. In Buddhist monasticism, in the monasteries, we have this wonderful system that if we can't agree, then we can't go forward, we can't make a decision. So that, you know, if it's four or five monks, and so one of them disagrees, then we can't do anything. We have to be in harmony or we don't do anything at all. So just one monk, even the most junior monk, my monastery's got 20 monks, the most junior monk ordained yesterday can say, I object. I don't think Ajahn Brahm should go to KL. And I wouldn't be able to come. So that's actually how harmony is most important. So if you can't decide, you have some sort of argument there and you can't make a decision, then don't do anything. Wait until you, both of you come together and actually you do agree. And the best thing to do is be the one who gives in. Be the one who gives in first. It's not just the woman, the man, whoever. If you're the one who always gives in, spiritually, you'll get to Nirvana first. Because you're letting go, you're renouncing. And also, you're the one, you're the rock on which the marriage is founded. Because you realize it's more important to have harmony. Us is more important than me. So that way that you can actually get a very sensitive and powerful marriage. And the decisions are made. Really, if there's any argument, you should be, I want to do what you want. No, no, I want to do what you want. No, no, you want. No, what you want. It has to be that selflessness. Now that might seem idealistic, but that actually works in marriages. It's a caring for the other. Once that caring is there, you have that wonderful relationship. And if you can do that with your partner, as if your partner is almost like your spiritual teacher, we call these things in Buddhism Kalyanamitta, good friends, beautiful friends. I know that some people, especially in Western countries, they look upon their marriage as like a spiritual partnership. Because it can be that intimate where you actually share things together and you share your spiritual growth together. Because being so close together in a marriage, in a relationship, you have to work together. It is similar in many respects to being a monk. You have to renounce what you want. You can't do this, you can't do that. When you were free, as it were, as a lay person, you could go wherever you want, do whatever you want, never had to worry about anybody else. But now you're in a relationship, you have to worry about someone else. Another person is involved. And soon, of course, when you have babies, you have more people you have to care about. That us becomes bigger. It's not a four-footed element, elephant. Soon it becomes like a centipede. all the feet in your family. And so they all have to work together. And it's not that hard to work together. And in learning how to work together, you learn about cooperation. And if there's one thing which this world needs, it's less individualism and more cooperation. I've said that in schools. I had this idea that in schools, instead of just giving all of the marks to personal achievement at the end of the year in your examinations, you should have at least 30% of your marks at the end of the year, whether it's going to university or just going to the next year at school. Maybe 30% of your marks should be averaged over your whole class. 70% is your personal score, 30% averaged over the whole class. Which would mean it's in your interest as a student in class to look after the weak children in the class, to help them along as well. Because their marks would affect you. Their performance affects your marks. You can see why I'm saying that. Because in real life, in a family or in a company or even in a monastery, it's not a group of individuals. We have to cooperate and we need to value cooperation and actually reward cooperation. Unfortunately, in our education systems, we only reward individual effort. We only reward competition. So when even we go to a company, it's always individual, me, my achievements. There's no such thing as us, the whole class, except of course in team sports. And in a company, it is a team. In a marriage, in a family, it is a team. In a monastery, in a BGF, it is a team, which we have to learn how to work together. And if we can learn how to work together in schools, I think we can also learn how to work together in life, and maybe there will be better relationships, and maybe there won't be so many divorces if we can train our children in how to cooperate and how to work together. And as we learn that working together, we can become married, we can actually have a relationship together, and we can learn how to work together in that relationship. Sure, it's hard work, but it's very rewarding. And if you can go through those problems, whether it's sexuality, whether it's learning how to live with each other, learning how to let go of your ideas, learning how to make up, learning how to forgive those faults, even if he commits adultery, forgive him. Hard thing to do, because women feel so proud and they feel that they can't trust the guy anymore. You can if you give him another chance. In Buddhism, we always do things three times. I shouldn't say that, because the man thinks, I've got three times. But no, sort of, in other words, don't. If a person makes a mistake, don't just throw away your marriage for one or two mistakes. People are human beings. But, you know, you men or you women, don't make those mistakes in the first place. That's the best. But when we have that forgiveness in a relationship, in a marriage, it can last much longer and it's much more fun. If they've done something wrong, that's their karma. They're going to suffer for that after they die. You don't need to suffer as well. So they say, you're going to pay for that, husband. Wife, I told you. Ajahn Brahm told you what's going to happen to you. Ooh, I wouldn't be in your high heels if I was you. But as for you, your job is to forgive. And to sort of give love, give understanding of your partner's weaknesses, and try and help him or her not to follow those weaknesses again. Because, you know, especially when you have children, it's a terrible thing for children to actually experience a divorce of their parents, because their parents are their source of love, their example of love. And it gets very confusing. When children, they love their mother, they love their father, they can't understand why their mother can't love their father, why their father can't love their mother. So it's in the interest of the children as well to try and work through things. And if you do work through the difficult times, even if your partner has been unfaithful to you, or, you know, if they said something very bad to you or whatever, if you can work through that and get the other side, you'll find that you have a relationship which is not a paper fire, which is a solid wood fire, and my goodness, that will last for a long time. And in your later years, when you get past the sexuality years, you become such close good friends, you'll be such a wonderful resource to each other in your later years. You've been through so much together, and your wife or your husband will be your closest friend, someone you've walked a long journey with. You've gone through many difficult times. Someone who you know, and they know you better than anybody else. What a wonderful thing that is, to have such a partner in the latter years of your life. So those relationships can be very fulfilling. But it takes a lot of care. It takes a lot of effort. And of course, you know that nothing good happens in life without care, without effort. Even as a monk, I have to work very hard. There's a lot of sacrifice as a monk. It's not just monks who sacrifice. You sacrifice as well. You have to say no to some of your wants and desires. That's part of life. That's part of Buddhism. So if you're in a relationship, make it a Buddhist relationship. A good and pure one as part of your spiritual journey. If you can do that, then you'll understand how next to actually to take that ability which you learn by learning how to live with a partner in life, take it further and learn how to create harmony in your relationships in life, so there'll be no more wars and conflicts. But that comes after the tea break. So, there we go. Very quick, I had to be short because we've only got half an hour for Q&A. So please, you want to get to the microphones? Q&A about marriage, sex, relationships.
Ajahn Brahm, does the Buddhist text condone the same-sex marriage? Same-sex marriage. Now, this gay and gay, and lesbian and lesbian. Now, associated with that situation, society normally frowns upon same-sex marriage. If such a couple were to come before you for blessing over their relationship, how would you handle that situation?
If a same-sex couple came to me for blessing on their marriage, how would I handle that situation? It's already happened several times, and I give my full blessings.
No, the initial question is, does the Buddhist text mention about same-sex relationship?
Does the Buddhist text mention same-sex relationships? They do. And it was only that if you're a practicing, say, homosexual, then you should look out very carefully before you become a monk, because you'll be living in a male community. But, that being said, there are two members of my community in Perth who used to be gay. These were two people who had partners, were gay men, and when they wanted to become monks, Buddhist monks, I had to ask them, I said, you'll be staying with other men in a monastery. Because it's a forest monastery, we spend a lot of time by ourselves. They said, can you handle that? And you know, they both said, well, we'll give it a try. And for 2 years, you know, as an Anagarika in white, before we gave them one year as an Anagarika, 1 year as a novice, I looked upon them very carefully. And they did restrain themselves. They did lower their lust towards fellow men. And they've been excellent monks. And you cannot fault them at all. And I'm so proud that I gave them the chance to live the monastic life. And they lived up to my trust and became great monks. And so why not? What's wrong with that? If a person can keep their vows of celibacy, if they're gay, they can become a monk. And it's the same if a person is committed in their relationship, a man to a man or a woman to a woman. If they can keep that commitment and it's a caring and loving relationship. I've seen many of those relationships and I can't see anything wrong with it at all. So again, the texts are quite clear on that. If it's not harming another person, not harming yourself, there's nothing wrong with it. And the only thing it says about in the text is be careful if they become monks, that's all. And it's nothing about that in the five precepts. All the five precepts say, the third precepts, is actually be faithful to your partner in life. It doesn't actually say what that partner is, to be faithful to them. So if there's a gay man, two gay people, they're faithful to each other, they're keeping the five precepts. A woman has a lesbian also, has a relationship with a woman, and they're committed to each other, a caring, loving relationship, faithful to each other, then that's keeping within the five precepts. And I'm proud to have such people as Buddhists, as members of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. The problem comes sometimes when people look in books. Because it says in the Christian Bible that homosexuality is an abomination. It goes against the law of God. But you know, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. And we shouldn't actually take those ideas into our religion. Buddhism is a compassionate religion. And as I said many years ago, and this was actually quoted by the Vice President of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore the other day, because I smiled when I realized she was actually repeating what I said many years ago. There was a woman wrote to me from Singapore, said her son was gay, just came out and told her he was gay. And said, what should I do, Ajahn Brahm? My son is homosexual. I said, oh, listen, don't you remember from the Loving Kindness Sutta, may all beings be happy and well? Aren't homosexuals a type of being? If all beings should be happy and well, all homosexuals should be happy and well as well. give your kindness metta to them as well. They're not sort of some, they're not outside of the beings you're supposed to have loving kindness towards, and that's your son, for goodness sake. So give him your love and support. And of course, when you come from your heart instead of the books, remember all the books were written from the heart, from the Buddha's experience of life, from the understanding of his heart, from compassion, from peace, from wisdom. And when you actually go into your own heart, you actually feel what's going on there. I can't see any reason at all, you know, why there should be discrimination against gays. And in fact, you know, some of the gays which I've known, I feel so sorry that they're persecuted. Just for being gay. They're not bad, they're not cruel, they're not harming society. In fact, they contribute huge amounts to society. I don't know why, but gay people become great artists, whether musicians or painters. There's something about, you know, their gayness which gives them that amazing sensitivity. And they contribute so much happiness and culture to our societies. Why they should be discriminated against, I can't understand. So if there's any gays here, welcome. Okay, anything else about... What about sex before marriage? Yeah. So, you know, tell your sons and daughters, if you are going to have sex, please, you know, have protection. Be honest about it, that, you know, many of them will, that without telling you. So teach them about protection. And actually, next of all, teach them how to protect their emotions as well. Because it's a huge act of intimacy. And it's not just, you know, the pleasure of the, you know, the intercourse. There's the emotional interaction there at all. And that can create huge amounts of, you know, suffering if it's not done properly. So make sure you tell your, you know, sons and daughters, be caring as well as careful when you have sex. Don't just do it casually, just as a pleasure. It's more important than that. It's more precious than that. So make sure that the partner you're with, you know, at least you feel something for them, you care for them. Otherwise, that things will go wrong. And that way, that, you know, you understand the reality of our world, which is being honest, which is the basic Buddhist principles of honesty, the fourth precept. You're not living in some delusion world of what, you know, the world should be. This is what people are like. This is what husbands are like. This is what wives are like. This is what monks are like. What the world is like, what gay people are like, you know, what children are like, what sex is like. Be honest, be truthful. And once you're truthful and honest, then you can actually make use of these things. You can do something about it and avoid all the problems. The biggest difficulty in life is this denial thing. We don't admit that it's happening. No, my son's not gay. Oh, my daughter would never, never do that. When she does. When your son is gay. So you're being honest, and once you're honest and truthful to life, you can do something about it. You can actually make sure that the huge problems which arise from sexuality and from relationships are avoided by facing the problems square on from the very beginning. So talk to your children, bring them up in an honest, good way, to be truthful to themselves and their emotions, and, you know, the hormones which rush through their body. As a young man and a young woman, it's so difficult because they're crazy. They're going through puberty, and, you know, these incredibly powerful forces in their body, they don't know what to make about them. They're scary sometimes because they're so powerful, and it's very hard to deal with. If they've got a sensitive parent who can sort of take their daughter by the hand, explain what she's feeling, acknowledging that, supporting it, acknowledging your son and supporting him as well, and they can do a lot for them in that difficult time of their life when they're finding their partner. They need help. They don't need criticism. They don't need fear. They need support. That's loving kindness. Got another question? Yeah.
Thank you, bro. May I know how can we inspire someone close to us, someone who is in depression or has some sort of problem that they can't go through? How do we go about inspiring these people? Say someone who is in our family.
Someone's in a family who's going through depression and you want to know how to explain what to them? The way through.
How do we inspire these people?
How do you inspire her to be? Okay. The thing is, if it's in a family problem like that, you can't give a specific answer, but you can give this beautiful general answer. Is actually just fill your heart with loving kindness, with metta. And if you've got real care, then when you're with that person, you know what to do. You don't need to plan and say, I should do this, I should do that. When I see her, I'll speak this. I'll tell her Ajahn Brahm's story about this. I'll give her a book on Buddhism. I'll give her a CD. I'll do this. Because sometimes if you plan too much, you're not being sensitive to the moment. Because sometimes if you're with someone who's depressed, you try and help them and make them more depressed. You know, just they need to be left alone for a little while. But sometimes they need you. And the only way to know what they need is just to be so quiet and sensitive, not to have some plans, but just to be there. And have this sensitivity, this kindness, which knows, okay, when to back off, when actually to engage. And after a while, if they know that you really care about them, there's someone there who really loves them, that by itself is a huge antidote to depression. Sure, they may be alone in that depression, but they know there's someone out there who's really cheering them on, who wants them to succeed and get out. You're like the person in the grandstand watching the soccer match. As long as you've got one supporter cheering you on, you're encouraged. Depression is a personal battle. Now, no one can actually do it for you. But if you get support, encouragement, maybe they can find their way out. There's someone to live for because you love them and care for them. So just a little bit of metta works a lot. And with that metta and with that sensitivity, you develop your own skillful means of dealing with that problem in the family of someone who's depressed. Even if it's, you don't have to succeed so much, you don't have to have a job, I'll look after you. You don't have to get the best marks at university, you don't have to become a doctor. Look, if you fail at everything, you can always join Ajahn Brahm and become a monk. Whatever happens, he'll accept you. So whatever it is, give them that sort of friendliness, that metta, and that sensitivity. And with that, sometimes they can come out of depression. There's so much depression in our world recently. Why is that? I think one of the reasons is because we're individualistic and because we demand so much to be considered successful in life. Success is such a big thing and the standard's very high. In the path to success means just, you get a little job and you get married and just an ordinary job was good enough. But now you have to be very successful, get a big condominium to be successful and a big car. So the bar has gone up so high that so many people just have got no hope of getting up to that level. And they feel they're a failure in life. You look at the magazines, the glossy magazines. Sometimes you see them in the newsagents. I've never seen any lady who looks like the pictures in the glossy magazines. But sometimes women think, oh, I should look like that. And they get so depressed. So you can see why it's depression, because a lot of the time we're living in a fantasy world. And we try and live up to those fantasies, and we can't, because it's fantasy, it's not real life. That's one of the reasons we get depressed. I don't know if that's helped you at all, but the major thing is just loss of loving kindness, metta. And if they are depressed, say, look, I give you freedom. You can be depressed. Don't try so hard. I'll love you even if you stay depressed. So don't hate yourself for being depressed. And that will allow them to relax a bit more. Imagine what it's like being depressed. Everyone wants you to be different. Wants you to get out of being, come on, you can get out of this. Go to see the doctor. There's something wrong with you. So you think, I'm really wrong, I'm depressed. It makes you more depressed. Got another question? Yeah.
Ajamba, would you encourage divorce if the husband has streams or girlfriends over the wife do?
Right, encourage what?
Divorce.
Divorce, okay. Only as a last resort. Because, you know, sometimes, like divorce, it's expensive, both financially and emotionally. The emotional expense is the most. So, I mean, usually it's... By the time people are thinking about divorce, it's a bit late anyway. They've let the fires run out and they're just looking at hatred. But sometimes you ask a person before you get divorced, why did you marry that person to begin with? You saw something in that person you really loved and cared for. Can't you actually see it again? I don't know, this is a beautiful story. I think it's in the book. But this was told me by a marriage counsellor in Singapore. It's a very funny story. That she was a marriage counsellor and this lady came up and she wanted to divorce her husband. She wanted to know how to do it. And the counsellor said, does your husband love you? He said, no, he doesn't love me at all. That's why I want to get divorced. And he said, look, this is not the right time to get divorced. She said, what to do? This is the counsellor saying, you just start dressing up a bit more attractively, be more kind and soft, get your husband to fall in love with you again. Now when he falls in love with you, then get divorced. And that will really hurt him. He said, yeah, that's right. So she'd see this counsellor in Singapore once every couple of weeks. How's it going? He said, hey, it's working. I've got this really nice dress, I put on some scent and makeup, I found out what he likes, he's coming home earlier from work. He's being really soft and I'm being kind to him, I think he's falling in love with me. Is he really in love yet? Well, I'm not sure yet. Well, don't get divorced yet, wait till he's really in love. Yeah. And so she kept on seeing this counsellor, he was falling more in love. And then she stopped seeing the counsellor for about a month, so the counsellor rang her up, said, what's going on, I haven't seen you for a while. And said, now what's happening? Does he fall in love with you? Oh, he's fallen in love with me now. Great, it's the time to get divorced. Oh no, she's so nice now. And that very brilliant counsellor saved her marriage. Because now she learned how to make her husband fall in love with her again. And of course once he fell in love with her, she fell back in love with him. It can be done. Because you did it once, you can do it again. But it just takes a bit of effort. So I think sometimes it's worth it. But don't wait till the last moment. When it starts to be a problem there, now don't just sort of think it's irreparable. Put some more effort into your marriage at the beginning, in the middle, and the end. And then you can save it. So... only as a very, very, very last resort get divorced. That's what I say anyway. Yeah.
I think Rob. In a marriage where there is hardly any fire, how do you start one? Now, seriously, associated with that question is a situation where the male may be impotent or the female may be frigid.
Okay. Yes. But no one is frigid. Well, they really need to do, they need to be turned on and inspired. The hormones are still there, they're just lazy. The ladies know how to sort of attract a man. Start doing it again. Go and get one of the magazines for teenagers. Go and put on a miniskirt, even though you're 60. Put some studs in your ears or whatever. Because really, all it really needs is for the other partner to realise you care. Because a lot of times, people have been married for such a long time, we take each other for granted, there's no spark, and he doesn't really care about me anymore. If you really care, you try something. Let's go out to dinner. Let's go somewhere different. Let's go off on some cruise on some ship. Who cares what it costs? It's more important. And you really care. You put in that care. I think that can be very, very sexually enticing. Especially if you know you care enough to, you know, to find out what turns her on. Or what turns him on. And I think that that can actually help a lot. You care enough not to think of yourself, you think of her, and how can I excite her? So try that. I think it was in Queensland or something, or somewhere in the world, there's a 66-year-old lady gave birth to a child. Sorry? Romanian, yeah, I mean, amazing. So, no, she could do it. So she could get a spark out of her husband, so surely... She was 60, so how old are you? Okay, don't have to answer that. Next question.
Hi, Ajahn Brahm. I have two questions for you. My first question is, you're saying that when two people are meeting together and start a relationship, this me and her, we are becoming us. I'm afraid when we become that elephant you're saying, I'm afraid we might lose a little bit of our identity. The caring that we show for the other person doesn't mean I have to lose also about my character. I have my own personality. If we become us, for me it looks like 1 + 1 = 1. We are the same person and we are losing a bit of our identity. This is my first question. If we become us, do you think that we are losing a little bit of our identity? My second question for you is, I'm discovering Buddhism. I'm here in Malaysia for 2 years now and I've been following metta meditation. There's one big problem I have with Buddhism, and it's about family. Siddhartha was in love and married Yasodhara, if I'm not mistaken. One day he decided he was caring for her, and like you're saying, they were two together and they were in love and they had a child. Siddhartha left his family. How can a person leave the person he has committed to, though it is for great care and for great love for humanity? He made a vow. He decided that he will love this person, he will care for this person, and that's what you are telling us today. How can Siddhartha that day have decided to leave his wife?
Okay, that's a very good question. It's a very common question. The first thing actually to comment about that second question is, when Siddhartha left his wife and child, he wasn't a Buddha yet. He was still an unenlightened person who made mistakes. And I mention that because sometimes the people come to me and they want to become monks. But they've got young children. And I say, no, that's wrong. It's wrong. If you've got that commitment, that duty to a child, you should keep that commitment, first of all. When your child grows up, maybe they're the very minimum 17 or 18, when they're becoming independent of you, then maybe you can become a monk. But in the meantime, you should do your duties, because I've seen in practice, if a person can't keep their duties in a family man or family woman, they come to live in a monastery, they can't keep their monk duties either. Soon they run away from the monastery for the same reason they run away from their family, just because it gets a bit too difficult and they can't sacrifice their own ideas. But with Siddhartha, it was a special case. It's not an ordinary person. For one, that I think it's very probable that that was a forced marriage, because his father wanted him desperately to become a king, to carry on the tradition, to take a wife. So I think it probably was a bit of compulsion there in getting married to begin with. But also, number two, that at least Siddhartha would have known that his wife and child would at least be financially well cared for. Emotionally, it was a wrong thing to do, but financially, at least, they weren't going to leave his wife and child in poverty. But I agree with you there, it's a fair comment, and I think it can only be explained by the fact that the karma of the Buddha was very, very strong. And it's not something which you would advise other people to do. And in fact, I don't advise other people to do that. But the other question about if you become married, are you losing your identity? This idea of identity is not a solid thing, because you know so far in your life your identity always changes. And there's no such thing as a solid identity. For as much as a psychologist would want to say that you only become a successful person when you have a solid idea of who you are, I think that's pure fantasy and very dangerous advice. It's much better to have a fluid identity, one which can change, which can adapt to time and to place. And I mentioned I've got a fluid identity. Now I'm a teacher sitting in front of people. When I go back to my monastery, I can just be like a concrete worker, or I can be like a hermit who just stays in my hut. And I can change my identity very easily, because you don't attach to any one identity. But the best thing about a marriage is that you can actually lose your identity. You can lose your selfishness, your ego, your sense of self into something greater. And that always is a wonderful thing to be able to do. To let go of your ego, yourself, and just merge into us. So I think that's a very positive sociological and psychological thing to achieve. And you do get much more happiness the less you think of yourself. All religions agree on that, and certainly I know that from my own experience. The more I think of other people, the more I sacrifice myself for others, the happier I feel. Like even like today, just working all day, I get nothing out of this except a cup of tea and lots of happiness. So the more I give, the happier and more energy I get. And you'll find that in your life. The more you sacrifice yourself for your family, you allow yourself to disappear, and us becomes a dominant feature. You'll find the more happiness you have, the more fulfillment you'll have in your life. So it's true what you say, your identity disappears. And it's a good thing it disappears. Does that make sense? Try it out and see. You can come back afterwards and say, why did you tell me that for Ajahn?
Okay, one final question.
Okay, thank you. A kind of a personal question. I just wonder, it's rare to find a Westerner becoming a monk. I just wonder what sparked that prompted you to become a monk. That moment that provided the impetus for you to decide that you want to forego everything else in the world and become a monk.
Well, I know that one lady came up to me and said, I know why you became a monk, Ajahn Brahm. You had a relationship, you fell in love with a girl, and it didn't work out. You became a monk to forget. I said, no, I didn't. That's not true. She said, there you are, you've forgotten. You can't win sometimes. Now, the reason I became a monk, for those of you who don't know the story, that because I've been a Buddhist, a lay Buddhist for many years, I'd heard from the Thai monks that you can become a monk temporarily, just for however long you like, you know, a few months if you like, or a year or 2 years if you like. But you could also do that in other traditions, but actually I like the Thai tradition, because actually the Thai monks in London anyway smiled the most, they were the happiest. And it did actually happen. I just finished a relationship. I remembered it. I haven't forgotten it. And I had a good career. I had my degrees. And I just finished, you know, my first year as a school teacher, which I enjoyed it. And I did very well as a school teacher. And I was in this very fortunate position. I had a good career. I had all my education in line. I was healthy. But I was free as well. And I thought, if I don't go off and become a monk just to experience the spiritual life, now, very, very soon I'd meet a nice girl, and this time it would work out, and you'd get married. And I thought that's what was going to happen to me. So I thought, this is a great time, it's the only opportunity I'll have. So I said, I'm going to go off to Thailand and become a monk for 2 years, and I'm going to come back again after 2 years, once, you know, I get some understanding of my spirituality. And then I'm going to go back to my job, or get another job, find a nice girl, and get married, just like everybody else. That was my plan. Not work out. And even the school where I was teaching, I still know the headmaster of the school, who's my boss. He still sends me a Christmas card every year and comes to visit whenever he's in Australia. And he said, look, when you come back, give me a call, you get a job straight away. And what happened, I think some of you have had similar experiences but in different fields of endeavour. After becoming a monk, after 2 or 3 days, I had this wonderful feeling that this is what I always wanted to do in life. Now you realise you've found your niche. And from that time on, that was over 30 years ago, I haven't looked back at all. Never once in that time have I wanted to leave. It's quite rare. I talk with other monks, sometimes they struggle with being a monk. Sometimes they think, should I stay, should I leave? But to be honest, never once have I wanted to leave as a monk. After those 2 or 3 days, I had the realization this is what my life was for. This is what I have to be. And I've been content ever since. And I told people at the time, they said, how long are you going to become a monk? I said, forever. Yeah, we've heard that before. I said, no, it's going to be forever. They didn't believe me at the time, but of course they begin to believe me now. That's not too late, but, you know, it was something which, obviously, my karma was right to be a monk. It happened so easily, and I enjoy that life immensely. And it's such a fortunate thing, whether you're a monk, or whether you're, you know, in IT, or you're an engineer, or you're a doctor. If you find out that life which suits you, and you're just so happy, it's such a fortunate thing to find a role in life which you feel just so comfortable and so happy with. So I'm a very, very fortunate person. Not as so much because I'm a monk, because I found a job, a profession, a role, which I've always found just so comfortable.